Welcome to the AZ Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Hamid Chojai, a tech enthusiast and entrepreneur. Recently, my wife and I sold our software companies and we're investing $10 million in Arizona's tech ecosystem. As a way to know what's happening in Arizona, every week I get to sit down with some exceptionally talented people who are doing some cool shit. All right, let's go. I'm here with Clait Mask, co-founder and CEO of Keep, formerly known as Infusionsoft. Hey, Clait.
Hey, Hamid. Great to be with you.
Awesome.
It's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been a while, yeah, for sure. And COVID didn't make it easy.
No doubt. It's good to be here in person. It's great.
I'm glad. So Infusionsoft is an incredible Arizona software success story. You guys have had, first of all, what's the revenue right now with Infusionsoft?
Yeah, we're about $100 million.
$100 million. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not easy making a $100 million software company. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to do it in Arizona. So you guys are one of the great software successes. You, as a founder, have been helping other founders and have been involved and have even invested in many of the sort of local software companies. So, and influenced so many founders, including mm-hmm. myself, by the way. So, so much for us to talk about and catch up on. But I also know that you guys have gone through a lot of turmoil and some layoffs even, and name change between Infusionsoft to Keep. So let's talk about that. Let's just jump into the sort of deep dive into the hard stuff, right?
Sounds good, yeah.
All right.
There's hard stuff?
What yeah, never. not in startups.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. There's a great story there and glad to discuss it.
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll be helpful to people listening. And at the least, it'll probably clear up some questions and things that people wonder about. Oh, what happened with this or that? So glad to talk about it.
Yeah, let's do it. So do you want to start at any particular point?
It's up to you. I mean, we can start about the work and the challenge and the grit required to build a business up to $100 million ARR.
Yeah.
We can talk about the...
I want to talk about that, but I want to talk about that a little later. Like something that surprised me a couple years ago, which is when you guys changed your name from Infusionsoft to Keep.
Yeah.
And when I looked at that as an outsider, I was like, that doesn't seem right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like something might be off,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed to be around the same time frame that some management was sort of like shifts were happening.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe we can start there and then go back, and because the success story is amazing, but mm-hmm. I feel like that has also been told a few times.
Yeah.
But I do want to talk about some of the elements of what's required to build a $100 million company too. But like, the interesting things from my perspective anyway, if we were going to lunch, I'd mm-hmm. be asking you about what the hell happened.
Right. So I love it. All right. So let me explain. So we were building the business. We were building Infusionsoft as the leader in marketing automation for small businesses.
Yep.
And creating that category, you know, marketing automation didn't even exist when we started to say we're marketing automation for small businesses. And we built the business we were approaching 100 million run rate. So we were probably about 80 million, something like that, 85 million. And we knew the market was telling us you need a light version of the software. We were hearing it constantly from customers, prospects, partners. Hey, isn't there an Infusionsoft light? And so we were working hard to create a light version of our software because Infusionsoft, super powerful, amazing in terms of its flexibility, its capabilities. The campaign builder, which we created back in 2012, was a total game changer for people. That drag and drop flowchart canvas type thing, that didn't even exist. When we first did it, people in mid-market and enterprise software were seeing it saying, oh my gosh, that's amazing. And so that campaign builder was really the kind of the crown jewel of the software that helped propel the company, but it was also very much a power tool.
Right.
And so the market's saying, hey, give us a lighter version of the software. And we who had created that powerful solution really struggled to create a light version. How do you water it down? How do you dumb it down? How do you take just a part of it when the real value, the real jewel of the software is a campaign builder? So long and short of it is in 2015 and 2016, we were working to create a light version and we just stumbled. We just couldn't get a light version of our software out. So I went to... And so the growth rate started to slow down a little bit.
Okay.
And as you know, in software, growth rate is everything, right?
Yes.
That was well done, right? It was almost like we rehearsed
Yeah.
It's everything.
In stereo.
Yeah. So, and especially if you have investors, right?
Right.
So we have venture investors, and they're like, look, you got to be growing faster. And of course, I knew that, and I was frustrated that we weren't getting that light version out. So as we started to feel disruption from below, which is where disruption usually occurs in software, because we weren't getting a light version of the software out, I was like, okay, I got to bring people in who understand how to create an easier version of our software. So I went to Silicon Valley. I got some people from Intuit, which makes QuickBooks, known for easy-to-use software.
Right.
I'm sure there's some listeners out there that would debate that. But I think generally speaking, they've done a good job of creating easy-to-use software.
Yeah.
So I brought those people in. And what happened was, it's so clear in hindsight, but what happened was there was a difference of opinion on the management team as we brought in these people from outside. Were we creating a light version of Infusionsoft? Were we creating a replacement for Infusionsoft? Or were we creating something entirely different altogether?
Right.
And when you're going through a product transition, which is what this is called in the software world, because no product in technology will be around for more than 10, 15, 20 years, you have to make pretty significant changes. So we're going through this product transition, and there was just differences of opinion. So in 2017, what happened was the management team that was coming in from the outside sort of gained control with the board. And that was, you know, ultimately that was my fault. I wasn't able to, A, get the light version of the software out, and growth was slowing. And B, I wasn't able to keep the management team and the board aligned. So we had factions on the management team and then misalignment with the board.
Right.
And there was kind of a founding group and a Silicon Valley group on the team. And it became really messy. And I was not able to lead us through that effectively. So I kind of got put in the penalty box and sort of was a figurehead CEO as we went through 2017, 2018, 2019. And the long and short of it is, we didn't sort out our product strategy. We were going through this product transition, trying to get a light version of the software out. And meanwhile, the flagship product was getting neglected because there was all this energy from the team trying to get this light version out. Now, I wanted the light version out as well.
Yeah.
We couldn't afford to not focus on the light version, but we really struggled from a management, a strategy, a team standpoint, and so the product transition was really slow.
Gotcha.
And what happened was the growth slowed, in fact leveled off, and then even went down in 2019. And it was that decline in revenue in 2019 that caused the board to say, okay, the team that we were trying to get to do this, that's not working well. So they gave me the reins back at the beginning of 2020. So for a little over a year, I've been leading the company again and having a blast and sorting out all that mess.
Holy cow. First of all, I did not know that story, and I could not have imagined you telling that story as honestly and transparently as you are, thank you for that.
Yeah, that's the story.
You were in a penalty box. That part is sticking out for
me.
Was. So talk about that. Like what does that mean, first of all?
It's super important for software founders to understand this. When you raise capital, you have investors, they require a certain growth rate.
Right.
And if you aren't delivering that growth rate and you're the CEO, generally, one of two things happen. They fire you or they put you into a different role. And that's hard for founders because we're used to not having a boss that we report to. But when you take on capital, you've got a boss. That's the reality. And so I own that totally. You know, I'll be honest, there was a period of time where I was really frustrated and I was you know, angry with the board. I was angry with the team. And I finally came to realize, you got nobody to be angry at but yourself. Like, you got yourself into this place, Clay. You made some mistakes leading up to the slowing growth rate. You made some mistakes in how you managed and worked with the board. You made some mistakes in how you led the team. And so it was super painful and frustrating to go through that, but I totally own it, and it was on me, and I didn't figure out how to get us through that product and strategy transition. And it caused a bunch of mess because from the top, you know, from the board and the management team, we were not aligned.
Yeah, that makes sense. So did the name change happen around the same time frame? Or?
Yeah, so what happened was the name change
was to double down on the easy to use system.
That's right. We wanted to create a light version, and when we created a lighter version of our software, we were super eager to put the name put a new name on it. And I felt like I absolutely wanted to change the name. I just felt like it was a little too early.
Okay.
Because we weren't through the product transition yet. We changed the name in early 2019, and we probably should have changed it in late 2020. That would have been about the right time.
Okay.
So, and just to be clear, the reason why we wanted to change the name so that we could get this message of we have a lighter, easier, you know, Keep is an easier, simpler product.
Yeah.
And we wanted people to understand that. And we felt like calling it Infusionsoft Lite would be like a little bit of a misnomer, and call, you know, this power, the brand of Infusionsoft was known for power. So it's like, it was like Jumbo Shrimp kind of like,
right.
You know, it's like, well, it's kind of weird. So, but we might've even stuck with that if, you know, dealing with the you know, that type of a naming convention. But we also recognized that where we wanted to take the company, we wanted to be able to appeal to many more customers, and we wanted a much simpler, easier name. Infusionsoft is a mouthful, and we always do that. And whenever you try to name different things, so you know, you name Infusionsoft University. Well, that's a lot. You know, Infusionsoft.
It feels like three words rather than two.
Yeah, exactly. So we wanted to simplify it. And the reason we named it Keep was the company's brand and essence has always been about encouraging small businesses and
keep
the
going.
Grit. Yeah. So it's it's keep going, keep serving, keep growing. And that's why we call it Keep. So I was good with changing the name. I just felt like we did it at the wrong time.
Yeah.
We should have done it a little bit later because we weren't all the way through the product transition. Now I feel great about where we are. I love the way that the brand is starting to, you know, is building momentum. The product line is now unified. The brand's unified. The Keep community is unified, where it used to be Keep Infusionsoft and Keep / Infusionsoft, Infusionsoft / Keep. It's like, no, we're just freaking Keep, okay?
So is our revenues growing again?
We are. So,
okay.
So yeah, we got when the, you know, you'd never like to see revenue decline. That's not a fun thing. But when we declined in 2019, that was when the board came to me and together we said, okay, well, there's a way forward here.
Yeah.
But I need to lead the company again. And so, and just, you know, for people to understand, for that, you know, roughly 3 years, I had my assistant and the COO that reported to me, and everybody else reported to the COO.
Right.
And I wasn't able to remove the COO. So
right.
I effectively was not able to lead the company. But again, and that's why I felt very disempowered and frustrated for a while. And then I came to realize, no, I got myself into that position. I got nobody to blame but myself. And I was very, very grateful that the board didn't remove me, because frankly, that's what usually happens when a VC firm backs an entrepreneur and the CEO doesn't deliver the growth, they usually get removed. So I'm grateful to my board members. I'm grateful that I got a chance to lead the company again. And so we got going again February 1st, roughly, started making
COVID
progress. COVID hits, and it was like, holy crap, man, what else do we need to deal with? But we gradually worked our way through that, started growing again in May, and we've grown every month since. And so for the last year, we've been growing, and the growth rate's starting to pick up, and we've got we sorted out a bunch of the messes that existed with team and strategy and product and brand, and so we've got the momentum going. It's really fun.
That's awesome. So what a great story. So was there some layoffs in between as part of that as well?
So we did layoffs probably four times going through that 2016, 17, 18, 19, basically one a year.
Wow.
All through that period. And when, you know, as you know, we've always built the company as a great place to work, an amazing culture.
Yeah.
You know, we've built the company on the philosophy that happy employees make happy customers, make happy shareholders. And we had a fantastic place to work. And when the management changed, that started to slip a little, shall we say. Philosophy was different.
Right. It's not a priority anymore, right?
Yeah. Like, and if it's not a priority, then you just start trying to you know, squeeze profit and that sort of thing. But in defense of that team, the product strategy was off, and the revenue growth was slowing. So what do? You've got to cut costs. And
yeah.
And it was really about 4 years there of like just cutting and like doing, you know, do more with less. And that's not the way to grow a company and build a great place to work. You've
right.
got to get the product right. You got to get the strategy right. You got to get the team right. And then you execute and build a great place to work.
What's interesting about this story is that I relate to it a lot, because with Axelsoft, we created a project management software that, you know, had a lot of traction. But eventually it started to sort of peak and then started to slowly decline. And no yeah. matter what we did, we seemed to like not be able to get out of that rut until years later, we finally invested in a new product and we sort of doubled down on the new product.
Yeah.
And in our case, the new product was in a different product category. In your mm-hmm. case, it sounds like you guys doubled down on a new product in the same product category. So is it that product? Is it the fact that that product is now easier to use and like more modern and
yeah.
like new code base, that sort of thing that you attribute to the success factor as well? Or
yeah, that's exactly right. So we did build. So what we ended up doing was in 2019, when we put the Keep product out, it really was not a light version of sales and marketing automation. It was a very basic CRM capability and a nice UI and a nice modern experience and a mobile experience. But that's not what makes Keep amazing. That's not what made Infusionsoft amazing. It's the automation.
Yeah.
That's what, if you think about Campaign Builder with its drag and drop, you know, sort of flow charting automation capability, you know, if you could, like people tell us all the time, if you can flow chart it, you can automate it with Infusionsoft.
Yeah.
And that automation is what made Infusionsoft incredible. When we initially created Keep, there was no real automation.
Okay.
So it was like, well, that's not, and you and I both, like you and I know in software, there's a ton of CRM solutions out there that are a dime a dozen. And,
yeah.
and they're, you know, they're sort of glorified Rolodexes. They don't really do anything
yeah.
for you. And so what we always believed was, no, it's got to have the automation, but we've got to create a lighter version of automation. Well, long story short, today we have our product line is Lite, Pro, and Max.
Okay.
And Max is what was formerly known as Infusionsoft.
Okay.
And so this Lite version has a really cool automation capability. We call it Easy Automations, and then the Campaign Builder is the Advanced Automations. So when you go into Pro, you get the advanced automations, and when you go into Max, you have all the functionality, maximum functionality.
Right.
So that capability didn't come out, that Easy Automations capability didn't come out until the latter part of last year.
Gotcha.
And that's why I say that's the point we should have called it Keep. And just changed the entire, not just the name of the company, but the name of the product. Because when we, in early 2019, we came out with Keep. We changed the name of the company to Keep, but we still had the Infusionsoft product.
Right.
Because it had a lot of brand cache, a lot of name recognition. You don't want to just kill your Google search with you know, changing that name.
Yeah.
So we kept the Infusionsoft product name until we actually, early this year, we changed that and said, no, Infusionsoft is now Max.
Yeah.
And so we have Lite, Pro, Max. Max, you can be on the classic version, which is Infusionsoft, or you can be on the modern version. But over time, those two things are converging.
Yeah,
that's right.
That makes sense. So when you took over last year and then COVID hit, did you guys immediately transition to work from home? You guys weren't a work from home company before, right?
Or correct. We did. We immediately transitioned. So on, you know, the pandemic was declared on the 11th of March. It was Wednesday, I think. By Friday, we were working from home. Many people were working on Friday. We came in on Monday, had a meeting, and then we moved everybody to work from home.
And yeah. and then what happened? Like, did you guys miss a beat? Did you find that it's better to have people working remotely? And are you transitioning back? What's going on?
No, there's a bunch of parts to the question of what happened. From a work standpoint, it actually went surprisingly well.
Like, yeah.
I was surprised.
I've said
to my team many times, wow, we executed really well. Over what I noticed was initially for that first month or two, we didn't miss a beat. Things went great. I think people were really dialed in. As time went on, there were some teams whose performance was degraded a little bit, went down a little bit.
Right.
But generally, you know, here we are, what, 13 months later, and it's been 14 months later, and it's been pretty darn productive, you know, pretty effective. So we announced last month that we're going to move in the once school starts, we're going to move to a hybrid model.
Okay.
Where our people will be working from home and working at the office. On average, people will be in the office 1 to 3 days a week. We're going to our seventh core value is we win together, and we're going to create Win Together Wednesdays, where on Wednesdays we're encouraging people to come in, and there's a collaboration and a connection, a creation that occurs when you're together, and that's hard to replicate. I've just found that when Zoom meeting's over, and there's not that hallway conversation and the little serendipitous things that occur as you're talking to team members. So we want to try to create that a little bit more, foster some of that, have a place where people can come and connect and be a part of it and be in the company. But some people won't, and we are hiring remotely as well. So obviously those people aren't going to fly into town on Wednesdays.
Yeah.
But you know, if they want to come in and connect to the mothership, doing it around a Wednesday would be a good time because right. there'll be more people in the
Maybe
office.
Maybe like once a quarter or something like that.
Yeah. And, yep. That's yeah. right.
That's awesome. All right. A little breather.
Yeah.
Holy
seriously.
Cow.
So I want to address, you asked, well, what happened with COVID? Because there's more, you know, we talked about the work, you know, what the work environment, but there was also, you know, we serve small businesses. COVID hit.
Oh, yeah.
And most of our customers are on a month-to-month agreement. So it was like, wow, well, you know, we got hit hard with churn in that first month. So from March, I'll never forget, from March 11th to March 31st, in that period of time, our daily cancels doubled.
Wow.
And that was a big, you know, that was a big hit. And meanwhile, you have a company that we're working to get back on track. We were just like, we would have turned positive and started growing again in March if COVID hadn't hit. We'd started off the month, we were all fires going great. March 11th hits and wham, everything slows down, you know, stops. But it was very concerning about what was going to happen.
Yeah.
The company was not in good shape when I took over back in late January of last year. And so it was a real leadership fire that we were in the middle of. And when COVID hit, it was like, you know, we didn't know what the ceiling was on cancellations as they were going up, you know. And,
yeah.
And so it was very concerning for those first few weeks. Our people were very concerned. And I remember we got everybody together and we said, listen, by the way, you have to also understand how concerning it is when there's been annual layoffs each of the last 4 years.
Right.
And the culture that was this great place to work had deteriorated. And so it was quite a leadership challenge. And we got everybody together and we said, listen, we're going to be fine. We had done some things when we reorganized at the end of January, beginning of February, to get our cost structure into a better place. And so we just settled everybody down and said, we're going to be all right. And our goal is to get through this pandemic and through the resulting recession without any layoffs. And, you know, we all went to work and we did that. And, you know, the company is now growing and we're hiring. And it was a very interesting leadership challenge.
I want to walk through that because the first time I actually got a sense of your leadership style and I was super impressed was when I attended one of your Elite Enterprise Forum sessions, mm-hmm. which was like 2 or 3 day. I forget if it was 2 or 3 days. But what I found very refreshing is the transparency that you had, the candor with which you speak, which you're doing that now. And, you know, I took back a ton of notes back to my company, and I forget, it was like 2000, maybe 12 timeframe when mm-hmm. when I went through that. You know, my question to you is that when you come back to a sort of a semi-broken company,
mm-hmm.
You're sort of in a leadership before, but like now you are more of a leader, right? Like,
right.
What does that speech look like to your employees in January before COVID, where you're like trying to build up morale again?
Yeah,
to where you want to keep them excited. You want to make sure that the best talent is not leaving the company.
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question because it's a really tough setting to walk into because the people don't understand why haven't you been doing stuff, you know, now you're talking, now you're saying you're going to do this, why haven't you done it before?
Yeah.
And it's a fair question for them, you know. It's like, well, they don't see it. They don't realize, you know, the things that have been going on. They don't realize the mistakes I had made before that kind of got us into that position. So all I could do was be my authentic self, be as open and real as possible, and help people understand, look, mistakes were made. I made mistakes. We went through a bad transition, but I know how to lead this company. And we will get back to growth. We will get back on track, and we will achieve the goals of the company. And so we just focused on starting to put wins on the board. And, you know, each month that you execute, people start to have a little more confidence, right? A little more belief. And so you have to have a pretty thick skin, though, because you've got a lot of people that are like, well, I liked the old leaders before, or, you know, a lot of the people that you had built the company with have left. And so it was, you know, there was plenty of criticism being, you know,
thrown around. Yeah. so when things are bad, the criticism comes from all angles.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, and it was bad. It really was. You know, we had a lot of work to do.
Including internally, by the way, right? Like
for sure.
You're sort of like doubting yourself to some degree.
You know, the good thing was I certainly had doubted myself at times throughout that period, but I had strong convictions about what needed to happen. Very strong convictions. And, you know, some people would look at that and say stubborn convictions. Some people would look at it and say, egotistical convictions. Some people would look at it and say, you know, idiotic convictions, whatever, right? But I had my convictions.
But what's funny is that in your role for those few years, you were sort of an outsider watching, even
Correct.
Though you were an insider.
And no, exactly. That's
you can
exactly
see the mistakes a lot easier.
Correct.
When you kind of step outside. Because, like, you had made mistakes prior to that, but you couldn't see them. But right. Now that you're sort of like watching someone else, you're like, oh my God, this is so obvious now to me.
Totally. And right. And that's why I had such conviction. It was really a gift that I was given to be able to watch. Because not only was I watching what others were doing that was working and that wasn't working, and it was both. It wasn't like the new leaders came in and didn't do anything well. They came in and they did some things that I was like, that's not working. And they did some things where they came in, I was like, oh, yeah, that's really smart. That's good. And so I had this really interesting opportunity to both observe the team and what they were doing that was working and wasn't working, and contrast that with what we had been doing and see what was working and wasn't working. So, you know, it's kind of like when, you know, a coach will take a player out and sit him down just to watch the game a little bit and see what they maybe are missing when they're right in the heat of battle. And it was awesome. You know, when I say I'm super grateful that the board didn't remove me, I got a lot smarter and I got a lot better. And I also got humbled by a lot of things that I had made mistakes on. And so when I got back, leading the company, whether, you know, people wanted to agree with or disagree with it, I had convictions and I knew some things that we could do very quickly to get the company back on track.
Clay, I want to say a quick thing, which is that there's no way you can call what you went through stubbornness, because most people in that position would have quit. I think I would have quit in that position. I think that's why you can't call it stubbornness. That's like truly like being humble to like watch and stay and knowing that you're not calling the shots and being patient enough for the opportunity to do it again. I don't know any other examples of that, by the way.
Well, I'll tell you, thank you for saying that. There's a lot of truth to that. I agree. In 2017, when the board began backing the other team, you know, everything inside of me was like, pound sand, man, I'm done. If you guys don't back me, and I just wanted to quit. It was like, fine. You know, if that's what you want to do. And I mean, I was very angry.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had to work through that process. And it's because of Charisse, my wife, that I didn't leave. You know, when I said one of two things usually happens, the board fires you or you leave. Like, that's
right.
Because most entrepreneurs, most CEOs, it's really tough to deal with that.
Yeah, for sure.
So I didn't quit for a few reasons. First and foremost, it was Charisse. I went home and I remember I was very emotional. I was very frustrated after that board meeting. And I was like, you know, they don't back me. They don't need me. I don't want to do this. I'm going to quit. And she was like, no, it just doesn't feel right. There's the job's not done. There's more to do. And this company needs you. And, And I kind of knew deep down inside that it wasn't, just wasn't right to leave. So I stuck it out. And there were other reasons, though. And, you know, I my coach helped me a bunch through that process. But most of all, the vision that I had for the company that was unrealized, that was unmet. When you work at the business for a long time and you're working to create an easy and powerful product line, and we were, you know, I could see us getting closer. It was like, gosh, I don't want to desert that. I don't want to walk away from that. Yeah. I'm so committed and passionate about the entrepreneurial small businesses that we serve. I wanted to see it through. And so, you know, the combination of Cherise helping me and the my coaching and the vision that we had for the company and the capitalism, you know, as you know, I'm a conscious capitalist. I totally believe in, I don't believe entrepreneurs should be ashamed or embarrassed about creating an amazing, creating a ton of value and then being able to participate in that value creation. Like, yeah. You should. That's part of what makes capitalism amazing. But I also believe in it, you know, from a conscious capitalism standpoint, blessing everybody, employees, partners, customers, shareholders, everybody associated with the business. And that's what Cherise would always come back to. She'd say, look, you have a heart and a desire and ability to do so much good with the business. You shouldn't be leaving it. And so I went through a very interesting 2.5 years from that point forward.
I bet. Okay. I want to move on to some other topics because Infusionsoft has also been instrumental to so many other small businesses. You guys had this massive conference.
Right. Icon.
Icon. So has Icon continued under the Keep brand or obviously not as Infusionsoft conference? I don't really know if you guys did the conference in 2019 but skipped it in 2020 because of COVID or like.
So we did Icon in 2017. We announced that we were going to discontinue it so that we could focus the resources on getting the new product out.
Okay. So you haven't done it for the past 4 years.
We actually have. So we didn't do it in 2018. We didn't do it in 2019. Within a week of taking charge of the company again, I announced Icon's coming back.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And so we announced that it would be in November of 2020. COVID hit, and so we turned it into a virtual event.
Okay.
And so we had about several hundred customers that participated, and it was awesome. It wasn't quite the same as being in person, but it really was good. And so we'll do it again this year. This year it's going to be hybrid, so it'll be in Scottsdale, and then there'll also be a virtual component to it.
Oh, fantastic!
But yeah, it's back. It's for those who have been to it. It is. I always say it's Mecca for entrepreneurs.
Yeah,
it's like, and it's, you know, our customer is not the entrepreneur that's raising capital and building a big company. Our customer is a small business entrepreneur. They're a lifestyle entrepreneur. And they use our software to grow their sales and save time to get some of their life back. That's what our automation software does.
Yeah.
It's such a life changer for these entrepreneurs. And when you go to Icon, you see it. And I don't know if you've ever been to it, but you feel this energy and this vibe of this community of people that are all about empowering entrepreneurs with automation software. And so, yes, Icon is back. We made it with a K, so it's Icon with a K, and you do our Keep sign. But yeah, Icon's back, and it's on again this year.
That's awesome. Awesome. All right, so you talked a little bit about capitalism. I want to dive into that. It wasn't on my list of topics, but there's lots of good with capitalism. Do you think there's any problems with capitalism in general? Right.
Like, yeah, I definitely do. You know, obviously, the reason I say conscious capitalism is because there's a form of it that's very much about enriching the business owner. And while I do think that the business owner should be enriched in the creation of what they do, it also should be enriching to the employees, the partners, the customers, the shareholders, everybody that's part of the business. And so I just believe in the good that comes from capitalism, where it is done in that enlightened way. So the kernel that makes it so good, you know, it's a very close cousin to greed. So you have greed when you go on the negative side, and you have this driving ambition on the positive side. And that driving ambition is important. And I think it's a mistake when when society's public policy is stifling that driving ambition. You need that driving ambition. And an entrepreneur that's facing a question of what to put into the business in terms of time, energy, capital, they need to know that there's an opportunity for a return.
Yeah.
And as you and I both know, when it's not like these decisions are made in perfect settings where there's a very clear outcome. Like these happen at 11:34 p.m. at night when someone's trying to decide, am I going to put that little extra work in to make this adjustment to my website? They come in moments where you're making little subtle trade-offs. They don't just come when they say, okay, are we going to put this block of capital investing it into this thing? So entrepreneurs have to have the promise of return.
Right.
Otherwise, they say, why am I going to burn the midnight oil? Why am I going to do those things? Not worth it.
What do you think is a valid criticism of capitalism?
Yeah, so I think where it starts to steer all over to the greed side.
Yeah.
Is that when the entrepreneur gets too selfish, too focused on themselves and trying to accomplish what they want to do individually.
Right.
And it's tricky because you have to have that it has to be rewarding and enriching for the entrepreneur. But when the entrepreneur focuses too much on themselves, then it turns into a greed game and the other people become pawns in the process. And so that is where you have to, you know, one of our values is we check ego. Like you have to constantly check your ego. And I think when ego starts to get untethered and starts to run amok, you're going to see problems in capitalism.
So diving a little bit deeper into that, because I couldn't agree more with everything that you just said, but you normally don't find founder-run companies having major issues like that, where the greed side is what's taken over. Mm-hmm. But then like two founders removed or two CEOs removed from the founder, now all of a sudden Walmart is run by some person who's there 4 years, 5 years, they're only looking at things from a quarterly perspective and stock price, and it becomes sort of all about shareholder value and not so much anymore about employees or whatever. And I don't want to pick on Walmart necessarily. I don't know any inside information about Walmart, but like it's after Sam Walton has moved on, now it's just, so what are your thoughts about, you know, like what should the public policies be around capitalism to help control greed to some extent?
That's a really great question. I don't know that you can control it with public policy.
Okay.
You know, what I learned going through my experience over the last few years is that humility is, you know, I would say humility and genuine care. If we weren't talking about it in a business context, we would actually call it love, right? We'd say there's a love, there's a care for people, for your business, for what you're up to, that transcends the dollars.
Yes.
And when that level of care is absent, it becomes about the dollars.
It
it starts to become just business, right? Well, it's not personal; it's just business. No, it's. There are people, you know, there are people that are a part of this, and you care about the people, you care about the customers, you care about the partners, you care about, you know, there's a care. So when you take care and you take humility, if you can instill those in the leader that is, that's leading the company, then you can avoid the greed part that comes out. And so I don't think you can legislate it. I don't think you can. You know, I think we can teach it. I think we can teach it in schools. I think we can teach it to entrepreneurs. I think we can teach it to boards and investors because, you know, obviously the investors need to get a return, and that's important. Like, that's critical. You gotta help them get a return. But sometimes if it just becomes about the return and just about the money, then, you know, you end up sort of losing the soul of the business and the humanity of it that makes it special.
Yeah, I agree. So you don't have a silver bullet for solving that world problem, huh?
No, I don't. I don't think, but I love, that's why I love the conscious capitalism movement.
Yeah.
Because it helps, I think it strikes the balance between societal good and business profits.
Yeah. It's a good balance between the two. I couldn't agree more. Okay. Let's now go back to building a highly successful company from the early days where you guys also struggled in the sort of like initial almost shut down multiple times. So I want to talk a little bit about the turning point, like right before the turning point of when you guys were starting and what happened that things turned around. I've heard you tell the story a little bit, but if you could sort of highlight one of those moments for us.
Yeah, there are two really significant moments. And it was about 3 years of white knuckle survival mode before we got the business really going. And about, it was Christmas time in 2003, so it was about a year and a half in. We had our first pivotal moment. And what happened was we were struggling like crazy. We were, you know, three co-founders and a couple of employees. The co-founders are bringing home a whopping $2,000 a month as long as things went well. Sometimes we weren't taking that home. And, you know, I've got four kids and a mountain of student debt and 8 years of college that I've been to. And Charisse is looking at me like, what are we doing? Why are we, you know,
doing this?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And it was Christmas time. And Charisse said, what are we going to do for Christmas presents this year? And I was like, I mean, we had nothing, you know, credit cards maxed out. Credit score is so low, we couldn't get any more credit cards, right? No money whatsoever, just totally stretched. And I said, you know, and just in that awful feeling, like, I got nothing, you know, I don't know what we're going to do. And she said, okay, well, I'm going to do a bracelet party where, like I did when we were in college, and, you know, have a bunch of people over and they'll order bracelets and I'll make, you know, make those bracelets, make a few $100 and use that to buy presents for our kids. And I remember just feeling this combination of gratitude and just, you know,
guilt,
total guilt and just awful feeling. Like, well, at the same time, we had created the automation capabilities in our software. It was the predecessor to the drag and drop campaign builder. And so it was sort of the equivalent of DOS compared to Windows. It was very like command driven. It was very old school. But we had this marketing automation capability. And our customers had started using it, and I was starting to hear rave reviews about it. Now, I was using our software every day to track leads, put, you know, as the CRM capabilities of it, to track the leads, put notes in, follow up, you know, make my call lists to prospects and that sort of thing. So when Charisse told me I'm going to do this bracelet party, I, you know, something clicked, and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to use that time to create our first campaign, this automated campaign. And so I remember distinctly that night she's doing the bracelet party and I was upstairs in the loft working on this campaign. And it was, you know, I'd figured out what it would be. It was going to be this, you know, seven steps to that it would go out weekly. I built out the structure of the campaign and I wrote the first email that night. And then I was like, shoot, I still have all these emails to write. And I realized, oh, I just need to write the next one within the next week, right? Because I'll be fine. So I went into the office the next day, had the campaign built out with one of the emails written, and we had about 1,500 contacts that we had been a list that we had been building over time using pay-per-click advertising over the prior 18 months, and so we had this list of 1,500 contacts, and I started to load up those contacts into this campaign, and then I thought, you know what? I'm going to do 500 today and then 500 in a couple of days and then 500 a couple of days later, kind of spread out. And then there'll be like this nice once, you know, every couple of days, there'll be people getting a message from me. So I did that and about a week went by and I wrote the second piece and loaded, you know, and about a day or so later, I got someone that contacted me and said, hey, I've been getting your stuff. Got a couple of questions. I answered the questions and he said, okay, let's give it a shot. Now, you have to understand that prior to that, the sales process looked like many, many phone calls,
right.
Lots of questions, technical questions. So for a guy to receive two emails from me and then all of a sudden call and say, I'm ready to buy with a couple questions answered, I was like, holy crap. You know, I took the order. I was like, I went into my partners. I was like, hey, check out what just happened. Remember I loaded that up last week, sent out this campaign. This guy just bought. At the time, we had one or two customers buying per month.
Okay.
So they took it as, oh, you know, coincidence, whatever, nice. And I was like, it's a lot bigger deal than you realize, but oh well. You know, they're writing software. I go
it's
back.
The first one.
Yeah. 2 days later, same thing happens. But this time the guy was ready. Literally, he said, okay, I've been getting your stuff. Let's give it a shot. Like I didn't even have to answer any questions.
Right.
I took his order, you know, and the guy, and it was like $3,000 or $4,000 plus $300 a month. I went into my partners and I was like, hey, this happened again.
Yeah.
And they kind of gave me a golf clap, you know, like, oh, nice. Yeah. Good job. You know,
you're like, we make payroll this month.
Yes, exactly. So then I go and it happens again 2 days later. I walked into their office. They all shared office, these three developers. I said, look, pull away from your keyboards. Look at me. We have freaking magic here. this is amazing. And so, you know, the first pivotal point was we started using the automation capabilities in the sales process.
Yeah.
In the sales and marketing process. And it was a complete game changer for us. Totally changed it. So then fast forward about another 9 months, the business was getting into a much, much better place. Each month we're building momentum. I'm telling Charisse, it's getting better, hon. It's getting better. It's getting better. Meanwhile, she's like, well, it's not getting better for me. This is, we're not, because we were starting to cover our expenses at the business, but we weren't bringing home any more money.
Right.
And it was because we were in such a hole at the business as well. So we're digging out of the hole in the business. I'm saying things are getting a lot better. She's like, you're delusional. There's like, we have no money. We have no food. We have nothing.
Right.
And you're saying things are getting better. And so one night we have this super hard conversation. We had this conversation many times where she's like, you got to go get a real job. This isn't working. I can't keep doing this. We've got four kids. We have no clothes, no food, nothing. Like you can't keep doing this. And I was delusional. You know, I was seeing what was happening at work and I was seeing that our product was getting traction, but I was not realizing that at home it wasn't making a bit of difference yet.
Right.
So that night we were had a very hard, tense conversation, lots of tears on both sides, and I just realized I wasn't going to convince her. She was like done with the way things were going. Couldn't keep doing it. So I said, she said, you have to promise me. I said, okay, I will look for a job. She's like, you have to promise me that tomorrow when you go to work, you will look for a job. And I said, okay, I will. And in my mind, it was like, okay, well, maybe I can go do work for a little while, then come back around to the business later as things are, because I know things are getting better. And so I rationalized, okay, I'll go, you know, I rationalized away this entrepreneur fire that was raging, saying it's getting better, it's getting better, it's getting better. So I went into the office the next day. I got in, started working leads, talking to customers, doing all the stuff I do. And before I know it, it's the end of the day, and I have not done any job searching. And I got up to leave at the end of that day and I felt awful because I was like, okay, I feel bad because I said I was going to do that. And I'm very nervous about what Charisse is going to say. So I get home that day, will never, ever, ever forget. I walk in, walk into the room, she turns around and she says, did you look for a job today? And I said, no. And she said, she walked toward me. She just gave me a huge hug. She just held me super tight. And I was like, okay, and I kind of tried to pull away, and she just held on to me. And then I could tell she was crying, and then I started crying. So we're both holding each other crying. And you can only really understand this if you've been at the brink as an entrepreneur in your marriage. And there's such tension. There's so much pulling apart that, you know, we're hugging, and then she, you know, finally kind of let go, and I said, what happened? And she said, everything's going to be okay. God knows what we're doing. Just keep going. And so when she said that, it was just like, man, I can't really fully express what it was inside of me because of what we'd been working through it with the business, trying to get it there. But I know what that rocky moment is, you know, that Yo Adrian moment when it's like, now you have your spouse in your corner. And I was like, we got this. Like we're going to go do this. And so it was those two experiences, the one of using our software and the second one of getting united with Charisse and having that keep going moment. And I say to people all the time, every successful entrepreneur has had their keep going moment, and every struggling entrepreneur needs to hear those keep going moments because it's so hard when you're in the middle of that. But it is just a matter of grit and perseverance. And when you're doing that by yourself, that's one thing. When your spouse joins you in it and partners with you in it, it's amazing.
Yeah, that's what an amazing story, and a huge shout out to the spouses of entrepreneurs. Yeah, right?
Seriously, they're saints.
Wow, that is a phenomenal story. How long in at this point in the company you guys had raised friends and family money
no money at that point? We were totally bootstrapped, and that was probably about 2.5 years in when that happened, and then it was about 6 months later that things started to really get better at home with the money was starting to make its way home. We were getting paid better. We were able to, put food on the table.
Like buy clothes.
Yeah, those kinds of things that weren't, garage sale clothes, that kind of stuff. So, and then it was about 2 more years where we were really having good success. And it was during that kind of years 4 and 5 that we began to raise a little bit of friends and family money. But frankly, I did not want to raise capital from anybody when we were going through those hard times. I didn't want to lose people's money.
Yeah, that makes sense. And one of the things that I heard you say years later when you did raise sort of VC money is the feeling of the satisfied feeling that you got from returning friends and family.
Yes.
Because you did do it.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that, because there's a good story in there.
Yeah, so we bootstrapped till about $7 million in revenue. A lot of times people don't see that or realize that, and they think, oh, we just got a pile of VC money. That's not the case. We bootstrapped to about $7 million, and when we were about $2 or $3 million a year, we had some friends and family invest. My parents were actually our first investors. I'll tell the quick story. So they... when we were trying to get on our feet in Arizona, we had a house in Utah that we couldn't sell. And so we couldn't buy a house in Arizona. So they made the down payment. And and I said, okay, we'll start paying once we get the business going. Well, 2 years had passed, 3 years had passed. We still weren't paying it yet. And I went to them and said, hey, I'm starting to feel like this thing's really going to be successful. Would you be interested in converting your debt, the debt, to stock? And they said, let us think about it over the weekend and we'll let you know. And it was a really interesting moment for me as an entrepreneur, because I had actually had a friend who was interested in investing in the business. He could see that things were happening, and I had approached him a little earlier because I was starting to feel like maybe we should raise a little bit of money. But in fact, he saw me one time. He's like, hey, are we going to do that? And I was like, I'm not ready to take your money. I just don't think. And so we didn't do it. And then, several more months went by, and I was starting to feel like this thing, I had this interesting shift from I don't want to lose people's money to, oh my gosh, I want the people that I know and love and care about to be able to profit from this. This is going to be really cool.
Yeah.
And so I approached my parents about it, and they were the first ones, and they said, let's think about it over the weekend. And they call me back, and I'll always remember this. They were like, you know what, son? We are so proud of you. We're so excited what we're doing. We want to do this. We want to convert our debt to equity and invest in your company. And I was like, okay, great. So excited about it. And I remember when I hung up, this little thing hit me, and I was like, they probably were like, looked at each other and said, do you think we're ever going to see this money? No, we might as well convert it to equity and see if we get something, right? But so they were our first investors, and that, that it did something. It put a belief in me, and I believed in myself to a little different level. And, my parents are amazing, and, I credit them for being our first investor to believe in us. And then we had some other friends and family and some employees and other people that wanted to buy shares. And so we did that in a friends and family round. And then several years later, we got when we raised venture capital, I think it was when we raised with Goldman Sachs, those people got a chance to sell shares. And we had some of those early people that made 100 times return on their money, which was
That's
just
amazing.
Amazing.
That's awesome. Yeah. Very cool. All right. I want to move off of Keep for a moment. What are you excited about in Arizona, startups? I know you've talked to a bunch of different founders locally.
Yeah.
Anything come to mind that you want to talk about in that realm?
Yeah. When I had kind of that, we'll call it the quiet period from 2017 to 2019, I didn't do much. I wasn't out there. I was really trying to figure out how to just stay in the seat and neither be removed nor leave on my own. And so I was very active before 2017. And then last year, I was not able to do a lot because of COVID and getting the business back on track. But I'm doing more now. You know, I like to be on a couple boards at a time. I love to speak to entrepreneurs. I love to do stuff like this. What I would say is I'm very excited about the climate for software entrepreneurs today. And I say software specifically. I am excited for other entrepreneurs, but you and I both know doing software in Arizona, there were very few people doing it successfully.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm appreciative to those who you know, came before us and did it and showed me a lot of things like Pat Sullivan and others. And
yeah.
So I've tried to help others. You know, raising capital is a real art, and it's understood in Silicon Valley. It's not understood here very well. And so teaching entrepreneurs how to raise capital is probably the most valuable thing I can do, frankly. But, you know, when people hear that and they say raising capital, it's not like, as you know, to raise capital, there's a whole bunch of things that go before it. And
right.
You have to have the vision, the story, you have to have the team, you have to have the product. You have to have so much laid out before an investor goes and puts money into it,
right.
Especially if you are raising capital for the first time. But circling back around to what I'm excited about seeing Arizona software companies raising capital.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about seeing—
The numbers are big, too.
Yes. We're starting to see some really good stuff. And over the last couple of years, we've seen some really good wins. So— You know, I love seeing that. I love seeing the Web PTs, the Campus Logics. You know, now there's a whole new crop of them that are raising capital and building companies. And, you know, to me, again, going back to conscious capitalism, building a company that you know, positively impacts employees, partners, customers, shareholders, everybody involved is just, it's noble work. It really is. And I love seeing entrepreneurs do it.
The Campus Logic mention is kind of interesting because I remember you calling me one day saying, hey, I'm going to send you this guy.
Yeah.
Whose name is Greg Scoresby.
Right.
He's raising some money for some startup. And I don't remember the details of that conversation, but I remember getting off the phone thinking, well, if Clayton's in, I'm in. But like, I have no idea what it is. Yeah. And it turned out to be one of the great successes.
Greg's done a great job.
Greg's done a phenomenal job as well.
I was on the board with them there for a couple of years, and just super happy for them and the things they've been doing. And they've got good prospects out in front of them. So.
Yeah, very cool. If you were starting something new today, mm-hmm. like is there an area obviously within software, but like is there an area that you would be focused on? What do you think the opportunities are for new founders right now?
You know, I'm pretty myopic. I'm probably not the best person to ask on that because I'm so passionate about small business entrepreneurs that I would do something in the realm of small business and entrepreneurship.
Hmm.
So, you know, I'm not great at canvassing the market and surveying opportunities and saying, oh, there's a gap, let's go do this. I'm much more about where's my passion, what am I fired up about? And then within that, where is there an opportunity? So, you know, I absolutely love what we're doing right now at Keep. I love it. You know, that to me is, you know, this an all-in-one sales and marketing automation platform that is easy and powerful and enables these small business entrepreneurs to come in and get started and then grow over time. That's my passion and my fire. I love doing it. And we've now got a product line that we get to do that. And so I don't have one bit of like, you know, an entrepreneur's wild hair where it wants to go and look at something. I don't have that. I'm like all in. It's probably the other reason why I didn't leave, because I'm so in love with this problem, this opportunity, this target customer, the market we serve. And, you know, we're to get to do all of that and then build a company, build a really amazing company is just so dang fun.
Yeah.
And that's what I get to do. So I'm totally happy doing that.
Now, when you referred me to Campus Logic or Greg Scoresby, at the time you were actively investing. Are you still actively investing in the...
I'm not actively investing directly.
Okay.
I have to build up my allowance a little more before I get to do that.
Charisse is she's like, okay, it's now my turn.
Yeah, we did about 10 investments, and then I did an indirect with the Arizona Founders Fund.
Okay.
But
with Romy.
Yeah. But next time we, you know, when we build up Keep and the revenue's growing again, and there'll be an opportunity at some point in the near future where I sell some shares and then I'll do some investing again directly.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I get to do it through Romy.
That's awesome. What else? Anything else you want to talk about? Are you in Dogecoin or Bitcoin?
I'm not. I'm not into that. I'm sure other people are and will do great, but that's definitely not my forte.
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about?
There's one other thing I would say. You know, I think this past year plus has been such a challenging time for people.
Yeah.
And I don't think we fully have I don't think we've done the math on how it's weighing on people. Everything from COVID, obviously, to social issues, to political issues, the divisiveness and the wasted energy, I'm going to call it that, yeah. on fighting is, I believe, a real tragedy right now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot about how we as business leaders can make an impact and make a difference in our communities and in the lives of our people. And so, I think when COVID hit, we all understood this is going to be a challenge, but I don't think we realized how the unsettling nature of that has just made us very, it's just raised the anxiety level and it's made us prone to arguments and
big time,
you know, fighting, frankly.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up because something just recently happened with Basecamp. I don't know if.
Yes, very familiar.
Yeah. So these guys put out, Jason Fried and the other co-founder put out their sort of statement that no more political discussions internally or whatever. There was a few other points as well, but that was sort of like the big key takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's created some controversy, but I feel like the reason they got to that stage is because of exactly what you're talking about, right? Sort of like elevated divisions in politics and the continued onslaught of divisiveness by media. And again, it's like both sides of media create the division.
Right.
And the political environment has been such that it's like not been conducive to having an open discussion and then going back to work with this person, right?
Right.
Like if you start having political discussions, you don't go back to work in a normal situation with someone. How are you guys dealing with that?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely, that's what kind of what I was getting at. So what I see is, there's a need for leaders to focus on what we share in common. And I, there's two things that I see that business leaders can do to address what's going on for people. I think one, we can be focused on truly creating a great place to work for our people and making a difference in their lives. There's a great McKinsey article out right now that talks about this challenge. Well, what can business leaders do? Because we want to do something. You want to get involved. And there are causes and ways that we can get involved. And I'll talk about that in just a second. But the argument that the case makes or that the article makes is that the most impactful thing we can actually do is create an environment for our people that helps to reduce their anxiety in life and helps to create a more balanced and a better state of peace and tranquility for them. Now, that's a little bit naive perhaps to think that we can do that as leaders. But we should certainly be trying.
Yeah.
And, just like anything, as entrepreneurs know, we all know how elusive balance is in life, right? When you're running a business and you're running your life. But it's the striving that matters. And if you're striving for it, you're going to be in balance sometimes. If you punt on it, you got no chance, right? So I think it's similar with this. We've got to create an environment for our people that can contribute to overall wellness for them, let's just call it.
Yeah.
And so the thing that I see that business leaders can do is be intentional about that. And this article calls out four characteristics of leadership that can help to create an environment that is healthy and effective for our people. And it comes comes down to the way that the leaders lead. And this is McKinsey, the number one consulting firm in the world, doing very soft, fuzzy stuff here in this HR stuff, right? But it's critically important. And the four characteristics are genuine care for your people with a level of vulnerability and openness that the humanity of that connection is felt. The second one is gratitude, which I consider to be a twin virtue of humility that I was really glad they called out, because gratitude at a time when things are so tumultuous is almost like a magic elixir for a troubled soul, if we can find a way to be grateful. And if we can model that as leaders and encourage that, it helps so much. So gratitude is the second one. The third one is positivity. And, you know, I talk about positive focus all the time. I lead with positivity. And sometimes people will roll their eyes at it, and they don't want to participate in it. And, you know, we lead meetings with a positive focus for people to talk about something they're positive about. And I can't tell you how many times it's gone, oh, I don't have anything positive I want to talk about. Yep, you don't get that pass. I'll come back to you. Think hard. What are you positive about? We need to push ourselves to be positive and find the positive, find the good. And, you know, I think when we do that, and we are looking for that positivity, we're looking for the good, it just puts us in a different state of mind as we go about the challenges and the struggles of the day. So, and I'm trying to remember the fourth one. I'll remember it when I stop trying to remember it. But that article, I think, was really powerful for what we can do as leaders to intentionally create an environment that's good for our people. So that's one thing that we can do. And then the other one is, I think this is where we have to get really good at showing and celebrating what we share. So you remember when you went through Elite Forum, I talk all the time about purpose, values, and mission.
Yep.
And this is where I believe business can have an impact, and that impact can extend out into societal issues depending on what makes sense for the purpose, the stated purpose, values, and mission of the company. So for us, our purpose is to liberate and empower entrepreneurs to strengthen families, communities, and economies. And it's the belief that sales and marketing automation can empower them to do that. Well, how can we take our sales and marketing automation to liberate and empower entrepreneurs, underprivileged entrepreneurs, minority-owned businesses, that sort of thing? So we've been doing that kind of thing and putting dollars behind that and putting programs in place, because we believe in our purpose and our values and our mission. We believe that entrepreneurship and sales and marketing automation is a massive game changer, and it strengthens, when practiced and executed effectively, it strengthens families, communities, and entire economies. So what we can do as leaders is we can be clear about our purpose, values, and mission. We can unify our people on the purpose, values, and mission, and then see how we can extend that purpose of values and mission out into the community to help address societal issues. Now, that doesn't mean that we all share, you know, we have seven values, and I say all the time. In fact, I said it today in a company meeting. The fact that we have these seven values that we share doesn't mean that we're all exactly the same. You know, you might have 62 values, and I've got 54 values, and Scott's got 37 values. But if we're all at KEEP, we share these seven values, and then we appreciate the fact that we have differences.
Right.
But let's come back to those values that we share, and this purpose that we share, and this mission to simplify growth for 1 million entrepreneurs worldwide by 2030, and let's stay grounded and focused on what we share. And, you know, I think that's the thing that we can do. Now, to the Basecamp issue. I like those guys a lot. I've read their stuff. I've followed them, you know, I think that their intention was coming from a good place, and they were wanting to weed out the negativity and the disruption and the fighting that was occurring. You know, it had to be painful for them to watch coworkers get in these fights over political and social issues. And yet, I don't believe you can tell people don't bring your whole self to work. Like, you bring yourself. And so, you know, what I would say is we've got to be more focused on the things we share and celebrate and be appreciative of the things that we don't share. But when those tensions come up because your value 37 conflicts with my value 42, we get back to the seven that we share.
Yeah. So in their specific sort of example, do you guys use a community or team communication tool like Slack?
We do. We use Slack.
So if such discussions start to occur on your internal Slack, Do you have any policies around that to where, you know, what is a practical thing for an entrepreneur to do? Like, and this is advice that I think that many entrepreneurs might be able to use from you because you have hundreds of employees. Mm-hmm. You got to be dealing with this stuff on a regular basis. So
yeah, we've had an issue or two that pops up, of course.
Yeah.
So, well, I'll tell you a couple of things. So first of all, the entrepreneur can stay focused on their purpose, values, and mission and bring people to that back to that constantly. When differences arise and passions arise around those differences, acknowledge them, appreciate them, and come right back to the purpose, values, and mission that we share. You know, that age-old saying, we share more in common than we have more in common than we have in whatever it is that's not in common,
there's way more in common between us than difference.
Yes, yeah, there we go. Thank you. Difference was the word I was trying to find.
Yeah.
And bringing people back to the common, right? So that's if an entrepreneur is listening and they haven't stated clearly their purpose, values, and mission, and there's a whole process of how you go through that. The best book out there on it is called Beyond Entrepreneurship, the original version by Jim Collins. Read chapter 2. Like that is the Bible for this stuff. He did a rework recently, which is good, but it's that chapter 2 of the original Beyond Entrepreneurship teaches entrepreneurs how to do this. You don't go just create it on your own. You have to like co-create it with your people and get really clear on it. So if you haven't, as an entrepreneur, if you haven't created your purpose, your values, and your mission to bring people back to, you need to do that.
Right.
And then, you know, we had an incident where a person posted something on Facebook on their personal site. It was offensive to many people. Most people, I would say, it was offensive to. And there was a real question. Do we let that person go right away for the, you know, insensitivity and the hurt that was created for a bunch of coworkers? Or do we have a conversation with that person? Do we handle it differently? In the end, we decided that if we were to just go fire that person, that would squelch the conversation. That would cause people to say, oh, shoot, I've got this view.
I can't share it.
I can't share it. And I'm just going to learn to, you know, not say anything. Well, that doesn't help us either. So we decided, no, let's have the conversation with that person. And of course, you get flack from the people who wanted the person fired right away.
Right.
But actually, we were trying to create a safe place for people that allows the conversation to occur. Now, in this case, the person continued on and they ended up losing their job. And then we got flack for removing the person. But you know, that's just the way
it
is.
But you gave an opportunity to you know, explain and, you know, like, and I think that's important because ultimately letting the person go, which, you know, is potentially the right thing to do. And it was after you gave the person a chance in this case. But it doesn't take away the problem. It just takes it away from your company,
mm-hmm.
right? Because the problem's still out there, right?
Yeah.
Like that person's still around and their opinion is probably even dug in further. So as a society, if we just decide not to interact with people that we have differences of opinion with, we're going to continue this route of division.
Yeah.
And it's going to get worse.
And that's the thing that's unsettling to me is, you know, just the nature of cancel culture and not having the conversation, that doesn't make it better.
Yeah.
Vilifying someone for their opinions is not a good approach. It just ends up polarizing and causing more trouble. So, you know, I just feel like having the conversation is more important and learning about ourselves and recognizing, you know, we have biases, we have experiences in our lives that cause us to think a certain way or perceive things a certain way. But, you know, this is where coming back to that genuine care that a business, you know, the leader has. If you've got that genuine care, and our number one value is we genuinely care. And it's because we, you know, we want to be better for each other. We recognize that we have our weaknesses and our challenges, but we celebrate the differences among us and we're united by our purpose, values, and mission.
Well, Clay, that's awesome place to start wrapping things up. It's actually been an absolute pleasure. I was not expecting the full-blown transparency, but I should have expected it because you've always had it, Clay. And I'm glad Keep is kicking butt again. And
we are. It's fun. It's really fun.
So great to have you on and talk to you about all kinds of stuff. And I'd love to have you again down the road if you're up for it.
Give me a year or so to keep building it, and we'll come back and give a postscript.
That's awesome.
And thanks for all that you're doing. I appreciate everything you've done for years. You've always been focused on tech in Arizona and helping entrepreneurs. And
thank you.
You and I are kindred spirits that way. And I appreciate the good work you're doing to help entrepreneurs, encourage them, and show them resources and connect them to different people. So it's getting better. You think about, you know, we're
it is.
You and I both, we look to our neighbors to the north in Utah, and we so want that just vibrant software and tech community. We're getting better. We're definitely getting
better.
Well,
they had a head start on us, right? In the 80s, they had Novell, which became a multi-billion dollar company by the 90s. And, you know, like that all sort of got going, and Corel.
Yep.
And
we're perfect. Yeah, totally. So, you're right.
Anyway, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. That's fun, Hamid. Great
Likewise.
To be with you.
Thank you. All right, you made it to the end of the episode. I would love to get your feedback, so take a moment to leave a genuine review in your favorite podcast app. That also helps us reach more people. Speaking of reach, if you like a particular episode, be sure to share it with someone who you think would enjoy it. See you next time.
All right.
Clay, that was amazing.
Yeah, that's fun. That's
Thank
good,
you so
good
much
time.
For
yeah,
doing that.
You
and thanks for the, seriously, thanks for the transparency and honesty about that. I think a lot of people would have been uncomfortable to talk about that.
Yeah, well, I would have been a few months ago.